Welcome to the Audio Digest of the American Journal of Psychiatry. This is Dr. Susan Schultz with highlights for July 2015. We'll discuss diagnostic precursors of bipolar disorder in offspring of bipolar parents. We'll also feature anxiety disorders. One study examined the intergenerational transmission of anxiety by looking at the children of twins. Another one focused on separation anxiety disorder in children and adults. Various diagnoses are characterized by impaired response inhibition, and we'll present a study of how it relates to neural activation in adolescents with ADHD. Irritability is also a common phenotype, and a longitudinal study tracked the stability of genetic and environmental influences on irritability from childhood to young adulthood. This article has been selected as meriting CME for readers who subscribe to the AJP CME course program. Each month, brief companion exams are created for three articles from the issue. By reading the articles and completing the online exam, individuals can earn up to one AMA PRA Category 1 credit per article. This activity is sponsored by the American Psychiatric Association. To subscribe, click on the CME link at the top of our homepage, ajp.psychiatryonline.org. We'll start the July highlights with the intergenerational transmission of anxiety. Anxiety disorders run in families, and studies indicate both genetic and environmental influences. Twin studies can ascertain how much of childhood cases are due to genetic and environmental effects, but they can't specify the extent to which genes and environment contribute to transmission from parents to children. One approach to this question is a study design based on the children of twins. The correlation between parent and child is contrasted with the correlation between the child and the parent's identical co-twin, the avuncular correlation. This method reveals the influence of living with one's parent over and above simply receiving half the parent's genes. Furthermore, comparing the avuncular correlations in families and monozygotic twins and families with dizygotic twins demonstrates the extent to which genetic and environmental factors influence transmission from one generation to another. If the two sets of correlations are similar and are significantly lower than the parent-child correlations, this indicates an environmental mode of transmission. Thalia Ely and colleagues conducted a children of twins study of anxiety by using data from the Twin and Offspring Study of Sweden. Data were collected on more than 800 families in which the parents were members of either monozygotic or dizygotic twin pairs. Anxious personality was evaluated in the parents through a self-report measure containing items on both social and physical aspects of anxiety. Anxiety symptoms in the offspring were measured with items from the child behavior checklist. The offspring ranged in age from 11 to 22. In the families of both the monozygotic and dizygotic twins, the correlation between parent and child anxiety was larger than the avuncular correlation. This pattern indicates a direct, environmentally mediated transmission of anxiety from parents to their adolescent offspring over and above any genetic effect. There are several potential interpretations of how the environment affects the connection between parental and offspring anxiety. Parental anxiety itself results in a rearing environment that's conducive to the development of anxiety in young people. For instance, the young person can learn to fear certain environmental stimuli by observing the presence of that fear in his or her parents. Another interpretation of the environmental pathway is that it reflects anxious parents engaging in negative parenting behaviors that promote anxiety in the offspring. A third possibility is that anxiety in the offspring influences the parenting he or she receives. This is compatible with findings that parents of anxious children and adolescents display parenting behaviors that exacerbate the anxiety symptoms. Another study of anxious children found that associations between negative parenting behaviors and the child's anxiety during a task were far stronger for mothers who were also anxious compared with mothers who were not anxious. So it's likely that there are effects in both directions. Bipolar disorder is our next focus. Most adults with the diagnosis recall having mood symptoms before age 18, and identifying bipolar disorder in children and adolescents may increase the opportunity to treat it in an earlier phase. This, in turn, has the potential to improve long-term course and outcomes. David Axelson and colleagues examined diagnostic precursors of bipolar disorder in a high-risk group, the offspring of parents with bipolar disorder. The parents were recruited through advertisements, other research studies, and outpatient clinics. Healthy comparison parents were recruited from the community. The study included all offspring who were between 6 and 18 years old. The mean age was 12. Follow-up evaluations were done approximately every other year until the offspring were a mean of 18 years old. At intake, the parents were interviewed about their offspring, and the children were directly interviewed with instruments for diagnosing mania, depression, and non-mood disorders in children. Subthreshold mania or hypomania was also diagnosed. It was defined as distinct periods of abnormally elevated, expansive, or irritable mood, including at least two DSM-4 manic symptoms. There also had to be a clear change in functioning, elated or irritable mood and manic symptoms for a significant part of the day, and a minimum of 4 days. Nearly 400 offspring of parents with bipolar disorder were included in this study. Relative to the offspring of the comparison parents, the high-risk offspring had significantly higher rates of subthreshold mania or hypomania, major depressive episodes, and manic, mixed, or hypomanic episodes. They also had higher rates of several non-mood disorders, ADHD, disruptive behavior disorders, anxiety disorders, and substance use disorders. Multivariate Cox regressions showed that in the high-risk offspring, subthreshold manic or hypomanic episodes, major depressive episodes, and disruptive behavior disorders were associated with subsequent manic, mixed, or hypomanic episodes. However, when the analyses were restricted to prospective data, only subthreshold manic or hypomanic episodes were related to the development of full episodes. The results differ substantially from those of other longitudinal offspring studies. The mean age at onset of manic or hypomanic episodes was considerably younger, about age 13. Manic episodes occurred before age 12 in half the offspring of bipolar parents. Also, a major depressive episode preceded the onset of mania or hypomania in only about half the cases. And the offspring of the bipolar parents had significantly higher rates of non-mood disorders before the onset of full bipolar illness. An editorial by David Michlowitz addresses the clinical implications of the findings. If a child of parents with bipolar disorder is showing signs of mania, depression, or disruptive behavior disorders, it may be reasonable to have the child evaluated by a pediatric mental health professional. However, the parents or high-risk child may not want early diagnosis and treatment. Many bipolar parents don't want their child to know about the parents' prior experiences with the illness. They fear that talking about it will alienate the child, or worse yet, cause the child to develop bipolar symptoms through imitation. and the child may reject the idea that he or she needs treatment for mood-driven behavior that doesn't seem any different from that of siblings or other children. However, an early psychosocial intervention may be more appealing to children and families than pharmacotherapy. There's a paucity of medication studies in high-risk children, and risks and side effects are associated with psychiatric medications in pediatric populations. Also, presenting early interventions to families is aided by focusing on the disorders that are currently present rather than those that might develop in the future. A parent may be more receptive to the idea of pharmacotherapy to stabilize the child's ADHD symptoms and improve school performance than to pharmacotherapy to prevent a hypothetical future episode of mania. Indeed, in the study by Axelson and colleagues, the majority of the children who had one or more risk factors did not develop bipolar disorder within the study's time frame. One can understand a parent's reluctance to engage their child in treatments to prevent illnesses that are statistically unlikely to occur. Presenting early intervention options to parents and offspring should emphasize the idea that family relationships can protect against the impact of genetic vulnerability. Traditional family intervention methods include communication skills training, problem solving, and behavioral parenting strategies. These may enhance resiliency in the family and reduce the likelihood of illness transition. It may increase the parent's and child's self-efficacy in relation to illness management to engage them in therapeutic approaches, such as family psychoeducation, in which parents and youth are instructed about identifying early signs of mood episodes and taking proactive steps toward stress and symptom reduction. Parents can be counseled to maximize environmental stability and supports by encouraging sleep-wake regularity, avoiding parent-child interactions with high levels of expressed emotion, and keeping records of the child's mood fluctuations in relation to medication changes or stressors. Parents can also negotiate with the school system to create educational plans that acknowledge the child's cyclic mood states and cognitive impairments. Whether these early intervention approaches lead to reductions in the onset of bipolar disorder or reduce the impairment associated with the illness are questions currently under investigation. Now we'll look at separation anxiety disorder. Traditionally, it's been a diagnosis assigned to children and adolescents, but DSM-5 removed the age-at-onset restriction because studies have found that later onset is common. However, there's very little epidemiologic data on separation anxiety disorder across the lifespan, and its relationship to other mental disorders hasn't been clarified. A long-standing theory holds that there's a specific developmental relationship between child-onset separation anxiety disorder and adult panic disorder and/or agoraphobia. On the other hand, a meta-analysis of community studies indicates that separation anxiety disorder may be a generic risk factor for a range of anxiety disorders in adulthood and for other psychopathology. To clarify these issues, Derek Seilev and colleagues analyzed data from World Mental Health Surveys. The participants were from 18 countries with varying income levels. The majority of surveys were based on nationally representative samples. The remainder came from samples representing particular urban areas. Nearly 40,000 respondents were interviewed face-to-face. The interviewers used the World Health Organization Composite International Diagnostic Interview. Both lifetime and 12-month DSM-4 disorders were evaluated. However, the module for separation anxiety disorder differed from DSM-4 in that it allowed onset of symptoms after age 18. With this expanded definition, the lifetime prevalence of separation anxiety disorder was about 5% in the total sample, but the rates in individual countries ranged from about 0 to 10%. Lifetime prevalence was higher among women than men in most of the countries, and it was significantly higher in the total sample. The pattern was similar for 12-month prevalence. Median age at onset was in the late teens in countries with high and upper middle incomes, and it was in the mid-20s in low or lower middle income countries. 43% of the respondents with lifetime separation anxiety disorder had an onset in adulthood. The proportion of lifetime cases with adult onsets was significantly higher in the countries with low or lower middle incomes than in those with upper middle or high incomes. The majority of people with lifetime separation anxiety disorder remitted within a decade of onset, but it was significantly comorbid with all but one of the other disorders evaluated. The presence of separation anxiety disorder was related to significantly elevated odds of subsequent onset of numerous other disorders, both internalizing and externalizing. There were also reciprocal associations. A wide range of other disorders were related to higher odds of subsequent onset of separation anxiety disorder. The findings are broadly consistent with the suggestion that these comorbidities are due to common causes more than to direct effects of particular early onset disorders on specific later onset disorders. A major exception to this reciprocity was for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Separation anxiety disorder was a significantly stronger predictor of subsequent ADHD than ADHD was of a subsequent separation anxiety. In addition to female sex and comorbidity, other predictors of separation anxiety disorder were lower education, childhood adversities, and lifetime traumatic events. Childhood adversities were categorized according to whether or not they involved maladaptive family functioning. Traumatic events and childhood adversities that were related to maladaptive family functioning predicted both pediatric and adult onset separation anxiety disorder. Of the respondents with separation anxiety disorder in the past year, more than a third reported severe role impairment related to the disorder. The rate of severe role impairment was considerably lower in countries with low or lower middle incomes, and impairment was greater in the presence of comorbid disorders. A phenotype found in numerous disorders is irritability. It's a stable, heritable trait that has both genetic and environmental influences. However, research has yet to examine the relative contribution of these effects across the lifespan. Understanding evolving genetic risk factors for irritability has profound research, clinical, and treatment implications. So Roxanne Roberson-Ney and colleagues examined irritability in a population-based cohort of Swedish twins between the ages of 8 and 20 using a developmental model that evaluated changes in genetic risk factors over time. All of the twin pairs in the population cohort were contacted for study participation. Data for more than 1,000 pairs were available for the analyses. The twins were assessed at 4 waves through a mailed questionnaire at the approximate ages of 8, 13, 16, and 19. At the first wave, the questionnaire was completed by parents. At the other waves, questionnaires were completed by both the parent and the child. The twin model allows for determination of the degree of similarity or dissimilarity between monozygotic and dizygotic twins. Twin data allow the covariation between measures to be partitioned into genetic and environmental components. The specific method used in this study allowed for disaggregation of the covariance into genetic components and environmental components that were either shared or not shared. For this cohort, studied from childhood to early adulthood, irritability was related to strong genetic effects in both males and females. However, the patterns of the effects differed by sex. The results for males provide clear support for both stable and dynamic genetic effects. Genetic influences were expressed early in childhood and were stable into young adulthood, and new genetic effects emerged in adolescence. The total of these stable and new genetic effects produced a consistent increase in the heritability of irritability for males over the course of development. A different pattern of genetic influences was observed for females. They had a robust genetic effect early in development, which diminished over time. But even though total heritability decreased over time, significant new genetic effects came online during early adolescence. These emergent genetic effects continued to exert influence through adolescence into young adulthood. Environmental contributions to the longitudinal course of irritability were also examined. Environmental effects common to both twins did not contribute appreciably to the expression of irritability in males or females. This indicates that familial environmental factors that affect twins similarly are not critical in the pathogenesis of irritable mood. Stronger effects on irritable mood were observed for unique environmental influences, environmental factors that cause twins to be dissimilar. Males and females both had a strong, unique environmental contribution to irritable mood in childhood, but this effect attenuated substantially from childhood into early adolescence. However, during early adolescence, new environmental influences also were detected for both sexes, but these effects also weakened over time. In addition, for females, a new environmental contribution to irritability also emerged during late adolescence, and it remained stable into young adulthood. Our final focus will be on attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Response inhibition is assumed to be a key deficit, but a meta-analysis showed only medium effect sizes with large differences between individuals. In addition, similar behavioral task outcomes can be due to different neural mechanisms. Don von Rui and colleagues investigated whether neural activity would be a more robust indicator than task performance in studying response inhibition in young people with ADHD. Research in healthy subjects has identified a core network of brain regions involved in response inhibition. These include a frontal striatal network and a frontal parietal network. The inferior frontal gyrus is generally linked to detection of salient cues, and it's thought to initiate the inhibition process. The response is further executed by the presupplementary motor area and basal ganglia. Attentional resources have a top-down direction and are thought to depend on temporal parietal and superior frontal nodes during response inhibition. Children and adolescents with ADHD, when compared with healthy subjects, previously demonstrated hypoactivation in frontal and medial nodes of response inhibition networks, as well as in frontal parietal nodes of the attentional networks. Literature on adults with ADHD has shown inconsistent findings. This study investigated neural activation patterns underlying response inhibition in a large group of adolescents and young adults with and without ADHD. Reaction time on the stop signal task was used as a behavioral index of response inhibition performance. Reaction time variability was used to measure attention, and error rate provided a measure of error processing. All the participants were between the ages of 8 and 27. There were three groups: patients with ADHD, their unaffected siblings, and unrelated healthy subjects. Each group had more than 100 individuals. Half of the ADHD patients were taking stimulant medication. functional magnetic resonance imaging was used to measure neural activation while the participants performed the stop signal task. The patients with ADHD had longer reaction times than the healthy subjects, and they had more errors. Both the patients and their unaffected siblings had greater reaction time variability than the comparison subjects. The patients with ADHD and their siblings also had low neural activation in frontal striatal and frontal parietal networks while performing the stop signal task relative to the comparison subjects. The activation in the inferior frontal and temporal parietal nodes in the siblings was intermediate between the levels of the patients and the comparison subjects. The degree of neural activation in inferior frontal nodes correlated with the stop signal reaction time, and activation in both the inferior frontal and temporal parietal nodes correlated with ADHD severity. Over all groups, the same patterns of neural activation were seen during both successful and failed stop trials. This concludes our audio highlights of the July issue of the American Journal of Psychiatry. Please visit our website, hap.psychiatryonline.org, for the complete versions of these and other articles, including author affiliations and financial disclosures. We also welcome comments. They can be emailed to hap@psych.org. Next month, our topics will include pharmacological management of Lewy body dementia, integrating primary care and behavioral medicine, depression subtypes in predicting antidepressant response, adjunctive clonidine in opiate dependence to decouple stress from craving, and amygdala hyperactivity at rest in paranoid individuals with schizophrenia. We hope you'll join us. Thank you for listening.